on goes the first boot. On goes the second. Puffer jacket. Rosie, should we go for a walk? There you are. Haven't had a walk for a couple of days, have we? Come on then, let's go.
I added one more podcast to the giant podcast bin. Now you have plucked that podcast out and started listening.
I took my microphone and found some human folk. Then I recorded all the noises while we spoke.
My name is Adam Buxton,
I'm a man. I want you to enjoy this, that's the plan.
Hey, how you doing, podcats? It's Adam Buxton here, out in the Norfolk countryside, at the very beginning of November 2021. November! Time. You stupid old bastard. Why don't you just sit down, have a slice of chill cake, and take a break. It is shaping up to be kind of an impressive evening. I reckon we're going to get a nice sunset tonight. Earlier today, it was absolutely beautiful. Bright, clear, cold. It's gone very autumnal over the last week. Anyway, look, let me tell you a little bit about my guest for podcast number 167, because it's a good long conversation, this one, so I don't want to waffle too much at the top. I am talking, as you well know, this week with Julia Davis, the British actor, comedian, writer, and director. Julia Facts. What have we got here? Julia, currently aged 55, was born in South London and grew up in Guildford before moving with her family to the town of Bath in Somerset. Julia's mother was a secretary and her father was a civil servant. She studied English and drama at college, then got into comedy, became famous towards the end of the 1990s, now lives in London with two teenage sons that she created with, is that the right term, with her partner, friend of the podcast, and comedy behemoth in his own right, Julian Barrett. Okay, so let's just go straight to Wikipedia now to help me summarize what is an intimidatingly large, impressive career. Julia is known for writing and starring in the BBC Three comedy Nighty Night, 2004 to 2005, and the comedies Hunderby, 2012, 2015, and Camping, 2016, which she also directed. She's been nominated for BAFTA TV Awards 9 times. But let's not get hung up on the awards. She has won and been nominated for many. Awards, yeah, yeah. She played Dawn Sutcliffe in Gavin and Stacey, 2007, and thereafter, her film roles include Love Actually, Cemetery Junction, Four Lions, and Phantom Thread. So, yeah, she's done a lot. And of course, more recently, in the podcasting world, there has been Dear Joan and Jericho, which she makes with Vicky Pepperdine, and many, many other projects besides. The conversation you're going to hear today was recorded in late October 2021, really not very long ago. As you will hear, I was able to sit down with Julia in a room. It was, in fact, a hotel room that I was staying in while I was in London doing a few bits and pieces the other day. It was lovely to see Julia. She's an old friend. I hadn't seen her for ages, not since before the pandemic, I don't think. Is that right? Yeah. And as well as talking with her about her reticence when it comes to doing interviews and the reasons for that, we also compared notes on losing parents and all that kind of fun stuff and what effect it had on Julia's comedy. It's not a straightforward interview or a comprehensive career overview. We do touch on a few of the things she's done over the years, but it's more of a friendly conversation between a couple of middle-aged folks prone to introspection, self-doubt, and worries that they might be responsible for the strange smell that was in the hotel room. Back at the end, with a bit more waffle and info about a few remaining book tour dates, etc. But right now, with Julia Davis. Here we go. Julia, can you describe the hotel for people listening?
I think before I describe the hotel, we need to talk about the room, which we've just been discussing, the slightly fishy waft of the room, which we hope isn't me, we hope isn't you. You said it could be a genital, but it could be the salad niçoise or it could be the toilet. You said a sort of alleyway, kind of. You don't know if that's the toilet cleaner or...
Did you get the fishy waft as soon as you came in the room?
I did. But obviously didn't say anything because I didn't know what had happened in here.
I still can't smell properly after having COVID.
Oh.
Yeah, so...
Oh, God. I mean, it's faint, but it's enough to go, something's amiss.
Because I went into the toilet... before you arrived, and I did think, like...
Did you pass a fish as you...
Well, I hadn't done anything. I hadn't even unrobed, disrobed, or taken anything out. And already I was thinking, like, this is kind of a back alley.
So you've got some sense of smell.
Yeah. Mm. Some things get through.
Yeah.
And that got through, and I thought, am I just not smelling things right? Sometimes the part of the COVID thing is that it slightly knocks everything askew, so smells aren't quite accurate, so nice smells can be unpleasant, etc. I don't think it goes the other way around. But I was thinking, like, is this the toilet cleaner they're using? Or does this toilet in this pretty high-end hotel smell a little bit like a pee-pee soaked back alley?
Yeah, I mean, it does.
Sorry about that.
No, I mean, it's fine. But you asked the description of the hotel. I don't know how to describe it, but it's quite flash, isn't it? It's quite, despite the troubles we had with the lift and the card and the...
Yeah, it's got one of the, instead of keys, they've got these credit card things, and you have to use them in the lift as well as in the door. And they demagnetize very easily. If you put them in your pocket next to your phone or your other credit cards or whatever, sometimes they don't work anymore. So we've just been going up and down to reception trying to get a new card. But when you come into this place, and this is not normally the kind of hotel that I would stay in if I'm in town.
Mm.
But I just think I thought, oh, yeah, whatever. I'll splash out this time. And so I paid a little bit more. And it's super chic, the whole place. It's one of these places that has groovy pop art, postmodern art on the walls. And, I mean, this used to be the sort of thing that I lived for, coming and staying at this sort of hotel. Mm. But haven't done it for years.
I think you deserve it.
I think
especially after what you said with that, where you were the other day. And slightly suicidal.
The other day I was in Cardiff doing a show. And I always just go for the cheapest option, more or less. And often I luck out and get somewhere that's quite nice. Anyway, this time didn't work out for me. I was in a kind of weird subterranean room with a tiny window. It was depressing as anything. So this time I thought, okay, I'll splash out. Yeah, it can be
very depressing to be away from home and suddenly find yourself in a really grim space.
Yeah, it's very hard to get perspective, isn't it, when you're in that kind of weird place alone, feeling like that's your whole world suddenly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you do just sort of think, what am I doing? What am I doing?
Especially
with my
life? You've just been, so that's when you're doing your book. And then what, so you've got all that sort of, you're doing your book, it's all funny, it's fun, all those people. And then you're going back alone to this, this sort of brown underground hellhole. Yeah.
And the only thing that saves you from going totally mad is the internet.
Mm.
So at least you can connect to the outside world and watch something to cheer you up.
I watch a lot of reality TV, trashy sort of. I find that very intriguing and sort of comforting.
Like which shows?
I'm always very behind everything in the world, as you know, in every possible way. Like I'm not on Twitter, I'm not on all the in that way, but then also in terms of like, so basically I started watching The Bachelor the other day, the first ever one in Australia, and then found out it was from like 2011 or something.
Uh-huh.
Have you ever seen that?
No. I know which one it is though. I know what you mean.
Yeah.
I don't really like reality shows.
Do you not?
Not so much. The only one I ever got into was Bear Grylls Island.
Didn't you do one?
I got invited on it.
But you didn't do it?
No, because COVID happened.
Oh.
I got invited on that. I went for a meeting with the production company. And it all looked as if it was going ahead. There were even dates. But then the dates started getting rescheduled. And then COVID happened. Mm. And then it's, I don't even know if they're still
Would you do an extensive training before going on, if you were to do it?
I mean, I probably should. Mm. You know, I'm 52. That's one thing I was thinking was, like, would I survive? I think I'd get ill. You know what
really?
I mean? Yeah. I think I'd get immediately ill. And then
what
I'd
start... What sort of illness?
I'd just get really run down and tired. And then I'd start thinking, oh, maybe I'm having a heart attack. And then I'd start crying.
Yeah. Do you think you would cry on screen?
Yeah, I would cry. And then they'd be filming it all.
Yeah.
And then I'd get annoyed. I'd go like, fuck's sake, don't film me. Seriously, just don't film this.
Yeah.
Their earpieces would be lighting up going, definitely film this.
Yeah. I was asked to do a Bear Grylls type thing, which obviously my boys wanted me to do. But I'm very unfit and I know I couldn't remotely do any of it. But I like watching them, yeah.
I know, I am interested in that survival stuff. Like, when it looked as if I might actually go on this Bear Grylls show on the island, I spent quite a long time looking at YouTube.
Yeah.
And watching videos about how to make a shelter.
Yeah.
And how to start a fire. These sort of things. I was really getting myself in the zone.
Mm.
But I was terrified. Also, the other thing that worried me... This was back a couple of years ago when me and my wife used to have a routine of basically drinking a load of booze on a Friday night and just eating a load of chips and
you
know, going nuts. Party night. And I really loved it.
Yeah.
It was a part of the week that I really looked forward to. But I felt guilty about it. I just sort of thought...
Even that one night a week?
Yeah, because it wasn't always one night.
Right. It was every night.
And I thought, God, if I go on the island, I'm not going to drink any booze or eat any sugar or smoke any cigs for 4 to 5 weeks or something.
Yeah.
At least 4 weeks. You know, there's a good chance that I might come out of it the other end and think, well, I never need to do any of that again.
Or you're going to have a breakdown.
Or I'll just go on absolutely screen. Nuts.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. I think that's half of what's scary about those things, isn't it? It's sort of revealing... those parts of yourself that you're trying to make sure no one ever sees publicly.
Yep.
Yeah.
That is the thing, isn't it? Well, Julia.
What do you think of these margaritas?
Oh, you pivoted to the margaritas before I was going to ask my
mine's
question.
Mine's completely gone.
Because you were leading me into a,
I was trying
a
to avoid
great
the question.
Question about things that you don't want people to see.
Am I drinking yours as well now?
Yeah, okay. We're having margaritas, seeing as it's, I'm kind of going high-end crazy and living the fantasy here.
Yeah, we've got it all. We've got cocaine, we've got margaritas, we've got...
But Julia, you said something there that made me want to ask you quite a great question.
Okay.
And that thing was that you are worried about people finding out of the thing that you wish to keep from them and
yes,
hide from
yes,
them.
Yes, I don't want them to know.
Is that, though, seriously part of the reason you don't like doing interviews? I mean, presumably, yes.
I think so. I think it's what I was saying to you earlier, which is I, in real life, probably do have quite extreme opinions or say quite extreme things. And so in interviews, I always feel I have to really curb myself. And therefore, I'm quite boring. And therefore, I just think, oh, I won't do it because, you know. Because you watch, for me, I'll watch people on chat shows who just have all the anecdotes and, you know, and I just think that's almost a profession in itself to be able to go on and just have some great stories. And, you know, because I remember even Rob Brydon saying to me, well, don't be yourself. You just go on and do some jokes and whatever. But that's not, I can't tell an anecdote really. And I don't, doing a joke isn't really my thing. So, yeah.
So you can't be like Tom Hiddleston. You can't go on and sit next to Robert De Niro and do a Robert De Niro impression.
I mean, that's incredible to have that confidence to do that, I find. Yeah. I think that's true, though, of more dramatic actors, isn't mm-hmm. it? Quite a lot of them. I think people who do comedy have a sort of hypervigilance, which is how you know if the audience likes what you're doing or doesn't. You're constantly re-gauging. Is this working? This isn't working. Do they like me? They don't like me. It's that, isn't it? And I think, obviously, those sort of actors are very brilliant, but often don't have a very sort of refined sense of humour or awareness of their impact
yeah.
when they're doing something like that.
Hiddleston is, he just churns them out.
Yeah.
He just doesn't know when to stop. I read an article from 2010 by Paul Flynn in The Gentlewoman. The Gentlewoman.
The Gentlewoman, yes.
Which is a magazine, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is now, I don't know if it exists in physical form. It's still online. And the article is online. It's entitled Julia Davis, Britain's Most Hilarious Woman. Do you remember this article?
I don't remember much about the article. I remember it being okay and doing a photo shoot that I didn't hate doing, which normally I do.
Yeah, it's one of those articles that is accompanied by photographs.
Mm.
And, yeah, people credited on the article are Paul Flynn, the writer, Alistair McClellan, the photographer, and the stylist.
Yes.
Jane Howe. That's how
good
you
stylist,
know.
Yeah.
You've got a...
You
exciting
got a
article
corking
going.
Trio.
You got a yeah. stylist.
Yeah.
And they really, yeah, you look great, and they put you in nice fancy clothes, and you're smoking in every single shot. And then the caption of one of the photos is...
Is it about me not smoking in real life?
Yeah. Julia, who doesn't ordinarily smoke, yeah. is wearing a gorgeous black wool coat over a grey cashmere jumper dress, both by Stella McCartney.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for someone who doesn't ordinarily smoke, you are smoking the
well,
hell out
I did,
of some ciggies.
Of course. I did smoke for many, many years, and then I didn't.
Right.
But, you know, you like to have a little prop in these,
sure.
in these situations.
But, you see, that's just 10 years ago. Well, 11 years ago. And already that just seems like another
age. Oh, my God,
age.
Is that all it is?
Yeah.
Because that feels, yeah, does feel like a horrifically long time
2010.
Ago.
2010. And the idea of doing a fashion
sure
shoot now...
Are you sure it's 2010? Oh, my God. So
with someone smoking.
Yes.
It's crazy.
Well, to me as well, it's the fact that the boys would have been 3 years old. And I didn't... When I look back on that, didn't think I had children.
Yes.
I think I forgot at that point.
What are you... Have you just done the Lizzie and Sarah pilot?
Oh, yes. Gosh, yeah.
So what was the deal with that?
So that was me and Jessica Hines, nay Stevenson.
Mm.
And we... got together and we used to do a thing. Do you know Resonance FM?
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, a free radio station. We used to just get together once a week in Borough, I think it was, and go and improvise an hour's stuff of us just doing characters and music, and it was really good fun. All the tapes got sadly lost in some flood or something.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, we developed these characters, these posh, put-upon 60-year-old women, who were in very desperately unhappy marriages. And I can't remember the plot, unfortunately. But we played them and then these awful teenage girls. And, yeah, we made a pilot called Lizzie and Sarah. And we were going to do a we'd written a series, but it didn't get commissioned to go ahead because... Excuse me, I'm just belching from this margarita. I'll try and keep that away from the fluffy microphone.
Lean in. People love belching.
It didn't get taken up because the lady in charge apparently watched it and said, in God's name, how is this funny? This is the darkest thing I've ever seen. And so that didn't go ahead, which is a bit of a shame because we did have lots more ideas. And then I remember being, very weirdly, being in a strange club one night and then some man coming up to me and saying, oh, I loved that, Lizzie and Sarah. Yeah, it was basically about domestic abuse, isn't it? And I kind of thought, oh, yeah, I suppose it is. And so maybe that's why it didn't take off.
Mm. I hadn't seen it, but it was supposedly a lot grimmer than...
Yeah, it was grimmer than usual, even grimmer than usual. I mean, it's weird. It was quite an interesting combination, though. Me and Jess, I liked it because... I think what I do can quite often be quite suburban or domestic. And she brought in guns and stuff.
Okay.
So I somehow ended up with a gun. And I don't know, it just had a different feel to it. And I think I did some music for it, which was quite fun as well. But it is, it's pretty bleak. But with some funny bits, I think.
Yeah. It's a fascinating snapshot, this article, which I'll post a link to in the description of the podcast. And he's got some good little insights, Paul Flynn.
Mm.
But he starts off by saying, on the scant evidence of 2 hours' conversation, Julia Davis is almost as maddeningly cautious in life as she is unhinged on screen.
Mm.
And he hones in on that, what he sees as you being very cautious and not wanting to reveal something that you would later regret in this interview.
Which is what we were talking about before doing this, really.
Yeah, and do you still feel that? Are you not? Is that not lifting a little bit as you get older?
Well, the margaritas are helping. I mean, yeah, I just think I'm not one of those people. Like, I think some people I don't really even think I'm in the public eye, but I suppose I am a bit. But some people like sharing themselves publicly, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
And they want to be known publicly and they want to share their opinions. And I just don't particularly want to do that. I don't see myself as a spokesperson for anything. I am very sensitive. I'm very prone to grotesque introspection and self-doubt, you know, and I don't really want to be challenged. And so I think I would likely throw out some comment and then, you know, I think if I was on Twitter, I'd probably be constantly engaging in things that might lead to arguments or something.
Maybe you would be the way that I used to be on Twitter, which was super cautious.
Yeah.
And then absolutely mortified if I got even one piece of criticism.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Want to go around and visit that person and sit down with them and explain myself.
Well, it was like even when you said, you know, I came to see your brilliant ramble talk, you know, your talk about your book, which was so, so funny. And I'm really not just saying that because I'm here, because I was weeping with laughter about the June Whitfield story.
Oh, yes.
Which I told my boys as well.
I had a sexy dream about June Whitfield.
Oh, it's so brilliant. I've now completely lost my train of thought.
Getting into spats on Twitter and
being
hurt.
Yes, you're talking about your bike.
Yeah.
And the man on the train and all that. And that would be me, like the feeling of persecution, wanting to explain myself, all of that. I mean, even Walter, one of my boys, said the other day that he got on a train and he was sitting there and he had one leg slightly up across the next seat to him. And this woman was saying to her kids, tell that boy to move his leg. And then Walter sort of went, oh, sorry. And then she said, you should know your place.
Wow, that's a very old-fashioned phrase.
And he said sorry again. And his friend said, why are you saying sorry? And you know, his friend was going, you should just tell her to fuck off. And then I was really torn between going, well, it's nice that you're being polite. But at the same time, yeah, why is she saying that? And that also reminded me of when I did the first series of Nighty Night, where we were filming in this cul-de-sac in Cobham in Surrey. And I mean, possibly I was in some sort of bizarre underwear outfit. I can't quite remember. It might have been the jogging scene where I'm in, you know, jogging around to see Don. But anyway, this woman came out who lived in one of the houses And she said to her dog, "We don't like that lady, do we?"
To the dog?
Yeah, with me right there. And of course, I said absolutely nothing. And yeah.
That's a thing, isn't it? When people vocalise their inner monologue via their pets.
Yes.
They do it with children as well, don't they?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow, that's full on.
I just bumped into you at the supermarket. I was backing out of a parking space and I hit your car. I'm sorry.
I didn't mean to.
But you're angry now, very angry now. And that's making me very angry too.
No, fuck you.
Some people might be listening to this thinking, well, for someone who doesn't seem to like talking about themselves, you certainly do seem to be on a podcast. But I pleaded with Julia to talk to me. I mean, I've known you for a few years. You fit the criteria for my favorite kind of podcast guest, which is that I like what you do, but I also like you very much and you're good to talk to. And so I just thought it would be nice to get you on. And you were reluctant for all the reasons that we've described. But I'm really grateful that you came on, and I will try and make it really bland.
Well, you, of course, as well, let's be honest, you helped me and Vicky very much doing our Joan and Jerrica when we were doing the book, interviewing us all about that.
It's called Why He Turns Away.
Yeah.
And it's one of the, you know, if you've listened to the podcast, it's a fair literary representation of
it is, but you know, I feel and I can't speak for Vicky, but I hope she might agree, you know, when we were reticent about doing a book because we knew that trying to translate our voices without sounding pretentious, but literally the voices of John, who's very sort of like that and quite nice, and you know, Jerrica, who's all sort of stern, like trying to get that on paper and hear that is really hard.
I would say, though, that if you are into the podcast, you should get the book because it's all new stuff in there, isn't it? Like,
oh, no, it is. It totally is. And I do, and you know, there's bits I like.
It's very funny. And you've got the insane illustrations, the kind of joy of sex illustrations as created by a psychopath, and some of which were done by your children, right?
Yeah.
You got,
but you know, it
do.
Was put. It was put in the genuinely put in the self help section in some shops, and then people complain. You know, it was like, I would say that didn't help as well. You know,
of course people complain. Why did they do that? That must have been someone just having a laugh.
No, they literally, because I rather tragically, you know, the first week it went out was going round to shops going, "Do you have the Joan and Jerrica book?" And
like
they were like,
Hartley.
Not heard of it. And then sort of, no, but we might in this branch over here, wherever. And I'd go.
In the sex branch.
And then it's like, oh yeah, it's in the self-help bit. And someone was very unhappy about it when they, you know, so.
I'm sure they were unhappy because it's absolutely filthy. I think it's one of those books that is going to have a life
Of its own.
Of its own, that will creep up on you and surprise you just when you're not expecting it. I mean, was the podcast was a sort of instant hit, though, wasn't it? I think that connected with people almost immediately.
Well, it was one of those delightful things, because I think, you know, in the world of comedy, you can spend a lot of time, you're writing, for me personally anyway, you're slaving away, trying to hone things and whatever. And I know anything I do is never going to be like a big mainstream hit, but you sort of hope it's going to reach people that like what you do or whatever. But that was just like really fun, and we had no intentions. I think that's a good thing, where you just do it and just think, we literally were like, well, I hope someone listens to it. It doesn't really matter, does it? No one's paying for this. And it was also slightly came out of, I'd done this pilot called Morning Is Broken, which was a breakfast TV thing. I don't know if you ever saw.
Ended up
with
on
Nick
YouTube. Muhammad.
Yeah. And playing this Scottish breakfast TV presenter. And through many strange events, it was commissioned and then it got decommissioned. And then my parents were both dying at the point. It was all awful. But the outcome was that I felt like I quite enjoyed that Scottish character. And I think Vicky had come on in terms of the series as a new character. And so we just thought, well, let's do something. And that was what happened.
What's the name of the real Scottish presenter?
Lorraine Kelly.
Lorraine Kelly. And that, yeah, so that's, it's a similar voice, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think I can't deny there's some sort of influence from Lorraine Kelly there.
Yeah. But obviously the joke being that it's kind of insanely inappropriate stuff that it would be funny to hear coming out of Lorraine Kelly's mouth.
Yeah.
And for those people who might not have heard it, it's a sort of, yes, it's kind of like an agony aunt thing. And they're reading letters from people about their sexual problems. Did you ever listen to LBC, the sexual and marital phone-in?
I don't think I did.
Oh, we used to listen to that in the 80s.
Yeah.
Like Dirty Boys, because they would talk very explicitly about sex. Anna Rayburn and the Capital Doctor.
I do remember Anna Rayburn, not on that, but in general. Was she ever on... I don't know why I remember, but as a kid, I remember.
Yeah, yeah. She used to do that on Capital Radio, that was.
Mm.
And they would just very matter-of-factly discuss these extremely explicit sex problems.
Mm.
And it was quite great.
And she's quite stern, wasn't she? Sort of quite attractive woman, wasn't she? Sort of
Yeah. Had there was something of the...
Kate Bush face.
Kate Bush face. I was thinking of who's the lady from the 60s who was the thinking man's crumpet? Joan Bakewell.
Oh, yeah.
Little bit Joan Bakewell.
Yeah.
And that, when I say thinking man's crumpet, that's not my phrase. That was
that's
the phrase.
That's my dad's phrase. Yeah. I remember that. It's so weird, that, isn't it? The thinking man's crumpet. Yeah. What does that mean? Yeah. Well, she was with Harold Pinter for years, wasn't she?
Yeah, that's right.
Is that right? That is right.
I think so.
Yeah.
She was that thinking man's crumpet.
Yeah.
I was wondering, though, because I read another interview with you in 2018.
Mm-hmm.
I've read, like, it's funny reading into, because, you know, we're friends.
Yeah.
But we don't, I mean, I ask you stuff about things you've done now and then, but I didn't have an encyclopedic knowledge of your career. And it's funny looking at it from a sort of interviewer's perspective and thinking, oh my God, you have done a lot. And you have sort of not stopped doing things. And you've worked with so many people and done so many bits and pieces and ploughed on. Mm. It is interesting getting that different, that career perspective from reading interviews with you. And there was one from 2018 when you must have been talking about Sally Forever.
Mm.
And you were talking about the fact that since you'd done camping, your parents had died and the Joan and Jerrica thing had happened in that period. And I remember seeing you after your folks died and you looked frazzled and I felt bad for you. My dad had died. My mother had not at that point. But because there was lots of children around, there never seemed to be the right moment to sit down and talk to you properly about it.
Yeah.
And also, I'm never sure if it's appropriate. Like, I'm never sure what the right thing to do is as a grown up. Are you supposed to just tough this stuff out?
I know. And I think for me, I sometimes feel like even, you know, all these years later, well, I don't know how many years it is, but sometimes I think, I don't know if I've processed that at all.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I feel for me, because they both got cancer at the same time, my dad died quite quickly and then my mum more slowly, but it was all around the same time. It was so shocking. And trying to, you know, be with them both and have kids and do all that, it was sort of like you just go into this mode of just dealing with something. That's, you know, and I think I'm good at that, but then what I'm not good at is registering what that's doing to me. Like, what do I really feel? And ages later, strange things make you really upset and, you know.
And also you think about death a lot more.
Oh, God, yeah.
And it's different to what you expected it would be like.
Yeah.
Thinking about it, that
yeah.
is.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you absolutely don't think about that. You have a sort of abstract idea of death when you're young.
Yeah.
and you think, oh, I don't fancy that very much. But it's so distant.
Also, did you ever... I used to have dreams about my parents dying.
Uh-huh.
Which, so I think they're sort of preparing you for it. Because you wake up and go, oh, thank God it's not true. And then,
right.
then it actually does happen. And I do remember when my dad, who I was closest to, you know, when he did die, I remember just thinking, almost feeling like... You never told me that would, you know, that you were just going to vanish. Because I think that's what it felt like. It's that thing of, even though you're, you know, if they have an illness that is slowly happening or whatever, like cancer, but you don't know, you just go, it's just the idea that at the very end, they're there and then they're just gone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so weird and shocking, isn't it? It's so sort of... I don't know. It's a very childish part of me that just thought, well, I didn't think you were going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you find that everything afterwards, when they were both gone, feels slightly unreal?
Like, yeah.
Okay, well, now I know what's going to happen. And now I've just got to go through the motions of doing my job and looking after my children and being friends with people and living my life. But it's kind of over.
Yeah, I know.
I'm not saying that that's true.
Yeah.
I don't think it is true.
Yeah.
And I think it's something that you probably come out of.
Yeah.
I'm hoping it
is. Yeah. But definitely, I just feel it's more than just the obsession with death.
Yeah.
It's like, which I hadn't been before. Just a feeling of... Well, also just the thing, you get older and then you... Because I can't remember who I was speaking to you the other day, but something about someone being about 80-something... And I was going, I don't understand how they're not thinking every minute of the day, I'm going to die really soon. Like, how do you... But, of course, some people are more, the reverse of that, aren't they? They're like, oh, I've got to make the most of it, mm-hmm. whatever. But, you know, I would like to be that, but I don't know if I will be, because it's like when people have some terrible disease. You get some people who go, I just had an epiphany from this experience and I learned everything. And occasionally you read about someone and goes, I learned absolutely nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And I quite like it when someone says that, because I suppose because I always feel this pressure that I should be having incredible revelations all the time. And I don't think I do.
Did you find, though, after you'd lost your folks and you'd been through all that, how did you feel about comedy on the other side of that? I mean, if you were doing Joan and Jerrica, that suggests that you were happy to go pretty hard into something extreme rather than perhaps becoming more sensitive or cautious or softer.
Yes. I mean, I would say, though, you know, I know my comedy isn't sensitive or soft or anything, but I probably am. So I think that the comedy I do, and Vicky as well, you know, like... I think Vicky and I shared quite extreme mothers, you know, which I think would result in those comedic sensibilities. So I think, I mean, we used to get hysterical when we were doing it because it was so ludicrous and rude and whatever. But so I think it was, I think my way of dealing with a lot of those really distressing things is getting hysterical. Because, you know, laughing and crying, that's pretty close, isn't it? Really, you know, it's... But that said, I mean, I think that's quite good. I think that's quite a good therapeutic way to deal with things. But I do think I have difficulty dealing with things seriously, you know, like, because a lot of people said to me, why don't you get some bereavement counselling or whatever? I mean, I don't know if you've done that. I just didn't. I've tried different therapy. I find it quite hard. And I always tend to turn away from that and want to sort of channel things in a different direction.
When you did get therapy, though, were you able to be honest with your therapist?
I think I'm very honest, and I'm also so serious.
Right.
That I find that quite horrifying, because I think when you do comedy, I don't think of myself as a comedian. And so I do think if I meet people that, you know, that didn't know me and go, you know, they expect you to be funny, and if you're not, they're really quite shocked and annoyed, you know. But at the same time, my favourite thing in life is chatting to people and friends and having a laugh about different things, you know. So doing therapy, I'm the exact opposite. I'm absolutely extremely serious and dour and depressing. And that feels really uncomfortable.
Well, what were your parents like, though? I mean, did they steer you away from that kind of introspection?
Oh, my God, yeah, absolutely. It was just... complete, that would be considered absolute indulgence.
Mm-hmm.
And And also, I think, a fear that they were going to be blamed in some way in within that therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Just not at all the world that they came from.
When were they born?
I mean, I don't know precisely. Sometime in the 30s.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So similar age to my parents.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's that generation, isn't
it?
And you really can generalise, I think, about a lot of people who were born around then.
Mm.
Because society followed rules in a more general way then, I think.
Yeah.
I don't think you can generalise about people so much today. But there's a good chance that people who were born around then, pre-war or whatever, were going to think, like, no, you don't talk about your feelings.
Mm.
Because no good can come of it.
Yeah.
Because if you open that door, then everything's just going to splurge out. You're going to embarrass yourself.
Yeah.
It's like, come on, life's tough.
Yeah.
You've got to get it together.
Yeah.
And it was all about, the best thing I can do for my children, who I genuinely love. Like, that's the thing. I never thought my parents didn't love me at all.
Mm.
I know they did.
Mm.
But their idea of the best thing to do for me was packing me off to boarding school and giving me a little shock. Like, this is what it's like when things don't go your way.
How much do you think, I'm turning the interview around on you now, but how much do you think that going to boarding school impacted your life and relationships?
Yeah, it's really hard to tell, because this is the other dangerous thing, right?
Mm.
Is that you can retrofit all sorts of explanations.
Yeah.
If you dig into this stuff and think, well, maybe that caused this, and maybe I'm like this because of that. And it's all making sense now. But certain things, I mean, it really is hard not to join the dots.
Mm.
I think that the experience of being suddenly separated from my parents and from my mum, and finding it was my worst nightmare that suddenly had come true, because I thought they were great, didn't want to go to boarding school. Suddenly there you are. And thereafter, I feel like I was desperate to connect with people and just like have very close relationships wherever possible.
Yeah.
Not just be friends, but like super friends.
Yes.
And if I was in love with someone, it was absolutely, had to be like, we are a unit.
Yeah.
Which is not workable and very off-putting for a lot of people. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
How about you? I mean,
well, no, it's interesting because I didn't go to boarding school.
Yeah.
But I think because I had, you know, without going into too much detail, a sort of difficult mother and therefore a neurotic relationship and what they would call an insecure attachment or something along those lines, that I was very insecure. And so my thing was, I always wanted a best friend, and all my school reports were like, she really lacks confidence, she's hiding behind so and so. And I always wanted someone to kind of hide behind or be. But also, like you say, like I still think the same, like always want connections with people. And so I think in a weird way, like coming to London and finding comedy and, you know, all the people that I suddenly found, like Chris Morris and all that world and Big Train and blah, blah, blah. For me, that was like suddenly going, oh, my God, this is like, finally, I don't feel quite as weird and out on a limb.
The fantasy is to be with someone who knows what you're like and knows the shittiest parts of you but doesn't mind.
Yeah, just gets everything about
you. Yeah, gets everything about you, knows where you're coming from,
is
never going to suddenly be appalled when they find out something about you that they didn't realise.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think I get that a bit from, say, you know, improvising, like when me and Vicky do stuff or Joan and Jerrica. It's sort of like, it's this kind of language where you just know you don't have to explain anything and you know when to be quiet and you know when to respond. And it's a kind of, that feels like a really nice connection that you can't really sort of fake, you know.
One of the things that Paul Flynn says...
Mm. Good old Paul. I mean, he's really come up trumps, hasn't he?
Back in 2010. I don't know what the ethics of this are, like raiding someone else's article.
I think it's fine.
Anyway, I'm giving him credit. He quotes you as saying, "I didn't have any friends in school. I think it just took me absolutely ages to find a way of being." And then he says, Julia says that things became okay, quotes, "when I got to about 16 and started dyeing my hair and taking drugs." And then he continues, "altering her state I've rarely heard a more compelling, if troubling, predisposition toward the art of acting.
Mm. Well, what I would say is, some of that's true. Saying I didn't have any friends at school, I think I did have friends at school, but I had a sort of best friend outside school, actually, and we would play dressing up every weekend. And
this was a real friend or an imaginary friend?
This is a real friend. She's real. She's still my best friend. She's still from, yeah, since we were nine.
Yeah.
But that was an area that was good. A friendship that was good, you know, but it was a bit of, interestingly, around playing dressing up, which I wanted to carry on up until I was like 14, and she had a boyfriend by that point, and I was still sort of, you know, playing with dolls and stuff. So, but yeah, I think probably when I was 16, I started to, I accidentally, my hair's naturally dark brown, and I used to henna it, like Kate Bush, who we mentioned earlier. And I tried to bleach it. I didn't know what happened when you bleached it. I don't know if you've ever bleached your hair.
No.
It's quite extreme. So I had sort of very patchy sort of clumps. And it was kind of orangey. And then, and so I cut it as well to try and make it look a bit better. And then it was a bit David Bowie. And then I thought, oh, actually, this is quite good. And so I think I then began to almost identify as a bit weirder. Mm-hmm. I certainly was trying to find an identity, and then I just, yeah, I just think I started to hang out with people who were more funny and strange, and that kind of made me feel much more comfortable.
And were you doing, would you do funny voices?
Yeah, which I did, had done from very young, but I just think my family wasn't really like that particularly.
Right, so Ma and Pa weren't going around the house doing like humorous
no.
accents.
I mean, my mum used to actually say she had no sense of humour. I mean, literally. And she don't think she did. My dad did. He did laugh a lot. You know, we watched Fawlty Towers, Monty Python, all those things. But it wasn't, I wouldn't say that humour was the sort, you know, some families are always like mucking around and laughing. And I'm always watching people on Gogglebox and envying their family life.
I know what you mean.
You know, and that was not what it was. Yeah.
My dad used to, just the word comedy, he used to repeat with dripping disdain. Comedy. Like the whole concept. What a load of shit.
Yeah, yeah.
What a waste of time.
Well, it's like my dad would have talked about most music as moronic.
Yeah, same as mine.
Yeah.
Is that real melody?
Heaven's in my phone charger. I left it right there. Woof. Did you see it? Have you got it? Where's my charger gone? Where's my phone charger? The battery's about to die. It was on the table.
Round and round in their heads go the chord progressions, the empty lyrics, and the impoverished fragments of tune. And boom goes the brain box at the start of every bar, at the start of every bar. Boom goes the brain box.
And so then you start getting, you get your improv troupe together, right?
Oh, that was a lot later.
Oh, okay.
I went off to university, did that for a couple of years. I was doing sort of drama stuff.
Right.
Then got ill.
Well, how did you get ill?
Well, I got ill with, it was something between glandular fever, ME, I'm not really sure. It was a sort of unknown viral
neurological shutdown.
Yes, and felt very physical. But, you know, obviously I endlessly analyse whether it was some sort of mental breakdown. I don't know. Anyway, it meant I didn't finish my degree. I was back with my parents, going slightly crazy. All these dreams I'd had at that point of being an actor were out the window because I just, my confidence just went. So then I started getting jobs like in a supermarket. Different things. I worked as a nanny for literally about a week and a half. I worked in a pub, worked in a finance office. I mean, just endless things. And finally, I went to join this local theatre group called Theurgia. And it was a serious drama group in Bath. And they were doing a show about a Greek show with masks. And I met this woman called Jane, who's 8 years my senior. And we were finding this serious thing very, very funny. And cut long story short, we sort of left this thing and decided to set up a double act. Became the Sisters of Percy. We did a, you know, we did a thing in back in those days where you had to get your equity card. So you have to do about six shows,
right.
Which we literally did to a few people in theatres around Glastonbury and Bath and whatever.
Yeah.
And then from that, we both joined an improvised group, which included many people, but included Rob Brydon and Ruth Jones.
And they just happened to be in that part
of the
world.
Well, yeah, I mean, I didn't... So, well, they were both in Wales. I'm not quite sure why they ended up in Bath. But, yeah, you'd have this sort of troupe of about 20 people, and you'd have four people per show. And you'd do a two-hour show and earn £25, which I remember thinking was incredible.
So how old are you when you're doing that?
25, 26.
Okay, so getting on a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, very old. Old lady.
And that, what's that then? That is the 90s.
Yes. Couldn't tell you exactly when. Yeah. 95, 6?
Right.
Yeah.
By the end of the 90s, you got your... Everything seems to, like from my reading, everything seems to just explode all at once. You get your Radio 4 show commissioned.
Well, yeah. What it was so also in our improvised group was Toby Longworth.
Yeah.
An actor, very good comedy actor. And his girlfriend at the time was a radio producer called Liz Anstey.
Mm.
And I believe, I may have this wrong, but I think she was making a show called Five Squeezy Pieces. And she put me together with Arabella Weir, Mira Sayal. And Arabella was sort of saying, come and stay with me and I can introduce you to Graham Linehan and Arthur Matthews and all these people. And I'd made these various like cassette tapes and videotapes of stuff. So a videotape I'd made of weird characters got to Steve Coogan, and then he from that asked me to join this tour he was doing, which also had Simon Pegg. And we were called the sort of, I don't know what we were called, I just remember us being referred to as the sort of extra bits, so that when he was getting changed we would do some characters or also do some stuff with him. So I remember doing a lady called Wendy Banachek with Alan Partridge, and she was a dry stone wall lady.
What's a dry stone wall lady?
Well, I don't know. She was just... I remember Simon Pegg described her hair as based on a cloud. And I just... He just interviewed me. I don't know. I can't remember that much about the show, but we did lots of bits and pieces. And the tour that was meant to be a few months extended to a year. But what I can't remember is whether we did Big Train after that. I think we did.
And then, because Brass Eye was...
Blue Jam and all that. Yeah.
Around. That was all around the same time, 97, 98?
I was only in one episode of Brass Eye, the paedophile special.
Oh, yeah, which was later on. That was 2000, maybe.
Was it? Yeah.
Wow, that's exciting, though. I mean, did it feel intense doing the Steve Coogan tour? Because Alan Partridge was already big by then.
Yeah, right? I mean, I was obsessed with Alan Partridge. And I also remember, like, the first time I saw Chris Morris, I didn't know who he was. I think he was in the Big Train auditions.
Yeah. And were you also a fan of his stuff, though, of the...
Yes, and then we did Blue Jam, the radio thing.
Right.
And then the TV thing, which was just Jam.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I just never remember the exact dates of that period of time, but...
You hadn't done Nighty Night by that point, though.
Oh,
right?
No. The first thing I did as a kind of, you know, stepping out of all of their amazing stuff was me and Rob Brydon did Human Remains.
Right.
Yeah.
And that went down very well.
Sort of.
Didn't it?
I think it was a bit of a kind of culty kind of thing. I do remember reading a review, and that was obviously my first experience of reading. And it was quite horrible because Rob had just made Marion and Jeff. Do you remember that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then our first episode was called An English Squeak, where I played a horrible posh lady. And he was, I can't remember our names, Peter and Felicity, that was it. And I was in love with this dead guy, my ex-fiancé, called Jeffrey. And there was some really weird review, sort of saying, why is Rob Brydon bothering with this woman? And why couldn't they come up with another name other than Jeff? Like a really weirdly sort of slagging off thing. And I thought, I don't like
it. I think I wrote that. That's cool, though, that you fell in with all that lot.
So lucky.
Yeah, that seems like the last point at which that was the old version of the way things used to be. I mean, I guess every decade now it seems that you get an absolute seismic shift and everything changes.
Mm.
2001, obviously, 9/11, everything felt that it had changed. But it hadn't really culturally changed all that much. And 2010, things were still quite a lot the same. But now it feels 10 years later that everything's shifted.
Oh, my God, yeah.
And things are unrecognisable to the point where I find it now quite hard to watch things that were made certainly pre-2000s, because they seem so of their own time.
Mm.
Do you find that?
Sort of. I know what you mean. It's because you can't help watching and not having that judgment in there. But I also have a weird thing, the same as people, I mean, I don't know if this is a bit controversial, but, you know, Michael Jackson, Roman Polanski, whatever, I personally feel I can...
Separate the art from the artist.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's not necessarily the same as what you're talking about with a culture we're in, which is a whole different thing.
No, but I think it is part of that. I think people nowadays, people younger than us... I think find that a lot more difficult.
Yes, yeah.
And don't really necessarily see the value in it.
Yeah.
They're like, well, why would I want to separate the art from the artist? You know, there's no meaningful division there. But of course, I think there is. And that, I mean, it's something that's always dogged you in interviews with people wanting to figure out, like, who's the person that makes this dark, weird stuff?
Yeah.
And are you dark and weird?
Yeah.
And I think as well, you know, there's definitely a sense in which people are particularly surprised because you're a woman.
Mm.
And for a long time, I really don't think that's the case now. I think things have changed in the last few years to the extent that it's not such a novelty anymore.
Mm.
And certainly you were a trailblazer in that sense.
Thank you.
But you know what I mean? It's that thing of like, wow, this is, are you going... particularly extreme because you're a woman? And there was definitely a sense like, well, men making this kind of material would not be questioned in the same sort of way, and
yeah,
people wouldn't be
it's
quite
weird
so
though
shocked.
Isn't it, because it's like, what men did make that kind of material? I don't know. I'm not saying they didn't. I don't know. Do you know what I mean? I don't even know what it is. I think that's the point for me. It's always been, I just write stuff in a really unconscious way, and I don't think, ooh, this is really dark. Ooh, this is really offensive. I really want to just cause a reaction. It's literally writing whatever comes to my head, and if it's making me laugh or whatever, you know. I think, like, if you're a stand-up or something, you want to put your views across and be a spokesperson or discuss. I don't know, but I don't. That's not what I do at all. So I think that's why I've always found it difficult in interviews to sort of analyse what I do or talk about it, or, you know, and think I actually come across as quite thick in a way, because I don't really know what I'm doing. I just, you know, it's just, I'll just think about, oh, that's quite interesting. I just think of one situation and then it all just expands from there. I don't sort of think of all the implications of what it is.
Yeah. And then... is it strange, though, to see other people who obviously are following in the tradition of what you do, but tweaking it so that it is less... well, I'm thinking of shows like Catastrophe and Fleabag that are making more concessions to the kind of things that would shock people, and they're building into their characters elements that aren't totally repellent.
Well, yeah, that's the interesting thing, isn't it? Because, you know... I don't know how those people wrote those shows. Like, I don't know if they're consciously thinking, oh, I better make them a bit more likeable. Or I sort of do, I do sometimes think, why am I writing such relentlessly? And that's a word that's used. Relentlessly horrible, irredeemable people. And sometimes I think I don't know how to write nice stuff without it sounding unreal or like a really crappy TV program. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's something to do with that. I mean, I don't know. Both those shows are quite interesting, aren't they? With, you know, both brilliant shows, Catastrophe and Fleabag, and much, so much more accessible than what I do.
But, you know, if you think of Fleabag and that technique she uses of making eye contact with the camera and breaking the fourth wall that way, it's very cleverly done so that it's not crass, but it is a way of connecting with the audience, isn't it? And just getting them on your side and inviting them in.
Yeah.
And it's hard to imagine you doing something like that because you have a childish glee in just not doing that.
Yes. I think I have a perverse thing of not wanting to be liked in that scenario as opposed to real life or something. I don't know. This is what I mean about analysing it. It's like, I don't know. I think it's like an area where I can just go, oh, thank fuck for that. I don't have to try and bloody be good or, you know, sometimes people would go, oh, it's saying the things that people really think.
Right.
I don't know if that's true without going into too much about my mum again, but she did say some incredibly strange things and quite rude things at times that have gone in, that are sort of...
Yeah, it all goes in, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I remember you saying that she hated comedy, but she liked Catastrophe.
Yeah, and that did annoy me because, you know, it's got some quite rude bits in it.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, because my stuff, she literally didn't even comment on it. I mean, it didn't exist as far as she was concerned. So then it wasn't like, I knew that she liked, not Mrs. Brown's Boys, another one about a much softer thing than that. Really gentle comedy.
Yeah.
You know, she liked that kind of thing. And that's fine. I could see that was far away from what I did. But Catastrophe, although not the same, I was like, oh, right, so you're happy with that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But not what I do.
Yeah, that stuff sticks with you, doesn't it?
What I do have is I sometimes do wish that I could write something more mainstream.
Right, okay.
Like me and Rich Fulcher once said, let's just, as if we could always have done it, we were like, okay, let's just stop with all this nonsense and write an amazing middle-of-the-road Hollywood hit. And we sat down.
Like as a feature?
Yeah, feature film. Like we, as if we just thought, oh, you just have, there's a, just a sort of basic, you know.
What kind of films were you thinking of?
Like a romantic comedy, you know. I don't know if I can think of an exact one, so it's not going to be Notting Hill or that flavour, but it's... But
what about
it's,
As Good As It Gets with Jack Nicholson?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, we came up with some ideas and just within two pages could not... Not only couldn't come up with a cohesive plot, but we're just like, couldn't make it not weird.
Yeah. What if she shits on him?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. I don't know how people find... You know, one of my favourite films is Bridesmaids.
That's good, isn't it? It's whenever that so comes good. On.
I mean, I've watched it so many times as also Step Brothers.
Step Brothers is a weird one, which I didn't enjoy when I first saw it. But whenever it's on, it always seems to be the bit at the event where John C. Reilly is playing drums.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the end and the sort of singing, the operatic singing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you met those people, Will Ferrell and Kristen Wiig?
I sadly have not. I've met John C. Reilly. I've been on his boat. Well, not his boat.
A boat.
Will Ferrell I've sadly never met. And Kristen Wiig I've never met. I did audition for a film of hers. The Barb and Star film.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But she actually ended up playing that part as well as the other part.
Okay. Selfishly.
So, you know, but if you're going to lose out to anyone, it's good that it's her.
Yeah. She is amazing, isn't she?
God, yeah.
That I'm always banging on about it, but that scene on the plane when she's pissed.
Yeah.
It's just directly connected to my humorous cortex.
Yeah.
I can't not laugh watching that.
I know. Every single bit of that film, it's all the set pieces. I love the her mum in it as well, who I think has sadly passed away, the woman who plays her mum.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember when she goes around to her house and talking about moving back in, and the mum's going on about her, the dad who's gone off with some woman years before, talking about her beaver. It's just really funny. Yeah, I absolutely love that.
Everyone's on top form in that. Have you seen As Good As It Gets recently?
Not recently.
Did
I know,
like,
it's Diane Keaton and Jack Nicholson.
No, that's the other one.
Oh.
That's the other one with a very similar title.
Oh.
That came after As Good As It Gets.
Well, then what am I thinking of?
You're thinking of... Hang on, let's Google this. It's another movie that I could never remember the title. And I, in my mind, I just always called it Not Nearly As Good As It Gets. Something's Gotta Give, you're thinking of.
Oh, so tell me As Good As It Gets.
As Good As It Gets is him as...
Jack Nicholson.
Jack Nicholson, he's got obsessive compulsive disorder. And
okay.
He lived next to...
Does he eat some fish in it at some point?
He eats some crab.
Yeah, and there's a... See, this is the problem. These are the kind of things I remember. And it's a woman, and it's not Ellen Barkin, but it's...
Helen Hunt.
Yes.
Who's brilliant in it.
Yeah. You don't see so much of these days.
No. She's very good. Who directed it? Because it came out in 1997. James L. Brooks. So you're in good hands.
Mm.
We watched it the other night, me and my daughter, and so my 13-year-old daughter, 17-year-old son, who it's hard to find movies for, especially stuff that I grew up with, that they're going to enjoy.
We've been watching loads of old James Bond movies, like Thunderball.
Right.
Have you seen that lately?
No.
Where Sean Connery wears tiny, like a onesie romper thing, which is like a pale blue toweling, completely showing his penis and balls. And then he gets stuck on some sort of machine that's meant to be a torture thing where he's face down and it goes really fast. It looks like he's shagging, like, really, really fast. It's just so weirdly funny, and I'm sure it wasn't meant to be. It's so funny watching it. And then he, obviously we know that James Bond in that era tried to get off with everyone at all points, but what I didn't remember was that he would just snog the woman in a really quite aggressive, dry way.
That's what women used to like, Julia. Aggressive and dry.
It was so weird to see it.
But As Good As It Gets did well at Castle Buckles. It was Jack Nicholson is really funny in it. But the most jarring thing is that he is so much older than Helen Hunt, and yet they have a romantic relationship.
Yeah.
So at first, like the first half an hour or 45 minutes of the movie is Jack Nicholson just being beyond appalling and saying all these totally racist, sexist things because that's what his character's like. He's got OCD, and I think, I may be misunderstanding, but I think part of it expresses himself in this almost Tourette-ic propensity for saying appalling things. And Helen Hunt is this person who sort of, she's a waitress, and she puts up with some of these things that he's saying because she's just a nice, understanding person, but she doesn't take any shit. Anyway, so everyone, you know, we're all watching it, everyone's digging it, and then suddenly you get a kind of romantic spark starts developing. Then my children got a bit worried, and my son said, whoa, no, I thought they were just gonna be bros. Are they gonna get it together? No, that's weird. No. And my daughter was like, yeah, he's like a lot older than her.
Interesting.
And I
whereas
said,
whereas we just accepted that in the 70s.
Yeah, my dad, I never thought about the fact that my dad was
60 years older than your mom.
15. I mean, almost. It could have been.
Yeah.
15 years old. That's a lot.
Yeah.
That is a whole generation apart.
It sort of depends at which point. There must be points in a relationship like that that are okay, and then it becomes weirder.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So I'm imagining if she was 30 and he was 45, that's not too bad.
That's right.
40 and 55. But when you're heading up, well, way earlier and where, I don't know what age they met.
I think she was pretty 10? Young. She was in her 20s. She was 10. Yeah, he was 25.
Yeah. That's a bit weird.
70s rock star style.
Yeah.
But, yes, it must, I think, I guess there's a part, there's a section in the middle where you don't really think about it. The older you get, it's more and more meaningless. But there must be a moment when, I guess, the first time you see one of his saggy old nuts pop out of his shorts when he's sitting on a camping stool. That must be, you must think like, oh, that wouldn't happen if he was 15 years
younger.
But
also, again, still, and I think it is still, that is a, considered a bit more okay for a man. Because if it was a woman and a bit of saggy old labia popping out the side of her pants, you know. Wait, are we saying, we're saying that's not okay?
That's not, is that a thing for women?
It could be.
I wouldn't mind. I'm always hoping for that, for that moment. Yeah.
No, but you know what I mean? It isn't, it still doesn't seem to be okay.
I don't think it's okay to see a saggy old pair of nuts pop out. It was never not shocking when it used to happen. And it happened a couple of times with me, and when my dad got to a certain age, and I think I even have a video still.
Is this because you didn't, I remember, is it those kind of shorts that had like a netting inside, but no proper pants?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think it was that.
Yeah,
it was out in France, and it was hot, and he sat on a low camping stool with his legs wide apart, sipping some chilled rosé, and I was videoing this picnic scene, and then I kind of zoomed in. I was like, "Hello, who's that hopping out there?"
Oh Lord!
And I've still got this footage of him with his saggy old, and just sort of looking around and enjoying the view, and me not knowing if I should say. I mean, what do you say?
Boys are out the barracks or whatever that Alan Partridge.
How are you feeling at this moment? Do you feel violated?
I feel like I need a wee.
Okay, have a wee.
No, but should I do that? I should wait till the end, shouldn't I, when we finish?
Well, it depends how desperate you are. Are you
also
uncomfortable?
You might record it.
I mean, I probably would record it.
I think the margaritas help. I don't feel violated. Okay, I mean, I might later.
Well, I didn't put, like, a bathrobe on and ask for a foot massage.
You did suggest that in an email.
I did. Because I thought it was... Sorry, I worried about... As soon as I'd sent the email, I thought,
That you said it was in a hotel room.
Because I thought it was a bit strange that we were going to be recording in a hotel room. Mm. It feels quite personal to go into someone else's hotel room.
I know what you mean. I mean, if I didn't know you better.
Especially if it smells of fish.
This is an advert for Squarespace.
Hey guys, it's Broshak with me, Paul Broshak. We got Mike here. We're going to talk about his new MMA comedy special. We're going to talk about his view counts, and we're going to talk about conspiracy theories. What's up, Mike?
Hello, Paul.
Hey, brother.
I'm fine, thank you. I don't want to talk about any of those things anymore.
You don't?
No. I want to talk about... I built a website, Paul.
All right, stream some fights, settle some beefs, stick it to the elites, that kind of thing.
No, it's mainly dog pictures, Paul. And I did it on Squarespace. Have you heard of Squarespace? I went to squarespace.com/Buxton and I did a free trial. And I tried some of the beautiful templates, Paul, and I typed things in. I dragged in pictures of the dogs. And before I knew it, I had a website, Paul. So I bought it and I've made some very sweet dog T-shirts and I sell those on the shop on the website.
Uh-huh. But do you still fight and stuff?
A little bit, but not really. Oh, and Paul, I wanted to tell you that when it comes time to buy your website or domain on Squarespace, if you use the offer code Buxton, you save 10%. Paul.
Thanks, Mike. Where'd you do that free trial?
Squarespace.com/Buxton.
And how sweet were the dogs?
Very.
Continue.
Sorry, Joy, I thought you were in a silent.
Hey, welcome back, podcasts. Julia Davis there, talking to me, and I'm so grateful to her for making the time, coming along, joining me in my stinky hotel room. It was good fun, nice to see her. Although we did exchange a few voice messages afterwards, because, well, I think you probably got a sense from that conversation that, as I said in the intro, Julia, like me, is prone to a certain amount of self-doubt. And she was worried that the conversation was a bit too serious. And she wished she'd been a bit sillier, and she prefers being in character doing those kinds of things. All of which I totally understand. But I really like talking to her, and even though I have that same thought a lot, like, oh God, I've just done another interview and I talked about my dead parents again and, you know, waffled on about my middle-aged anxieties. And why can't I be like, you know, Dave Shumker and Graham Clark on Stop Podcasting Yourself? It's my favorite Canadian podcast. You tune into that every week, and they just talk to comedians, and they keep it light, but, you know, they're still intelligent, and they're funny, and they just make jokes and make each other laugh, and I think, why can't I just do that? But I can't. I'm at that point in my life where I'm thinking about all this stuff, and you know, these aren't straight interviews. If I was sitting down and doing a more straightforward interview, then sure, I probably wouldn't bang on about my various anxieties to quite the same extent. I'd probably find a way to crowbar one or two in there, of course. But anyway, I guess what I'm saying is that I appreciate some people would probably prefer it if it was always a bit more bants heavy, this podcast. But I guess I'm not Jimmy Bants or even Tommy Bants. Anyway, maybe I can convince Julia to come back on the podcast sometime. And the mission will be to only be stupid. No serious conversations allowed. Still, I really enjoyed talking with Julia, and I'm really grateful to her for doing it and for letting me persuade her. Hope you enjoyed it. Tomorrow, I'm heading up to Aberdeen for a book tour show. I think that one is sold out. Then I've got a day off in Aberdeen. And then on Thursday, I go up to Inverness to do a show at the Eden Court Theatre. Yep, it's Inverness time. Guess what? There's still plenty of seats. The stalls are looking a lot busier than they were a few months back. But if you want to go and hang out in the balcony area, what is that, the circle, of the Eden Court Theatre in Inverness on Thursday the 4th of November this week, then you're in luck. Because currently there's only about two people up there. Liverpool and Manchester next week, sold out. And then the last few book tour dates are in Ireland towards the end of the month. Belfast, 20th of November, that is sold out. Dublin, Vicar Street on the 22nd, that's the very last date. I can't tell from their website whether it's sold out or not. I think all the seats are sold out. I think maybe there's standing room there. Don't know how attractive a proposition that is. Cork Opera House on Sunday, November the 21st, not sold out. That might be doing even worse than Inverness, I think. There's only about five people in Cork that want to see A. Buckles reading from Ramble Book. So do come along. You'll be able to stretch out. It would be nice to see you. What else? Went to see Dune this week with my daughter. It was sort of exactly what I was expecting. Having spoken to a couple of people who'd seen it, read a couple of reviews, and seen the previous films of Denis Villeneuve, I just started off loving it. Look at the clothes. Oh, look at the spaceships. Oh, look at beautiful Timothy Chalamet and his angular face. and his great hair. Oh, great space guns and impressive fight sequences. And then about 2 hours in, I started thinking, I wouldn't mind it being a bit more exciting. Just tiny bit, like, or weirder. You know what I mean? I found myself thinking, oh yeah, I remember this scene from David Lynch's version. And actually, even though overall David Lynch's version was a mess, there were quite a few moments in there where he really nailed something strange and spectacular and creepy. The Baron Harkonnen stuff, syringing the Baron's pustules, and the Baron pulling out the heart plug of one of his slave boys and then drinking him like a milkshake. All that sort of stuff. There wasn't anything like that in the new version. Found myself thinking, you know, I wouldn't mind if Sting turned up in his pants at this point. Thank you very much indeed to Seamus Murphy Mitchell for his production support and hard work on this episode. Thank you to Becca Teshinsky for her additional production support. Thanks to Helen Green. She does the artwork for this podcast. Thank you to everyone at Acast for all the help they provide. But thanks very much indeed, most of all, to you, listeners, podcasts, quartermasters. Once again, you made it through an entire episode, and now here you are, just about to be given an audio hug. Some people don't like the audio hug. I got a message from someone saying, love the podcast, tend to turn off before the hug and the screaming. Which is fair enough, isn't it? I think I probably would too. Oh God, now he's going to hug me and shout. I'm out. I understand. But then of course you miss out on like and subscribe, which is, in my opinion, one of my crowning musical achievements. If you haven't switched off, come here. What's creepy about that? Nothing. Until next time we meet, take care. I love you. Bye!
When I do an interview, I go right back into sort of 5-year-old at school mode, where I think I'm being asked questions and I've got to give not all the nice good answers to the teacher and not get into trouble and all that. And, you know, I think it makes for many cul-de-sac style anecdotes where I'll sort of go, yeah, I like watching reality TV. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? I don't know. I just completely compare to sort of people who come on who do comedy, and it's just very, very funny. I think I'm just funnier in character or with other people, not necessarily as a generator alone in that way. Well, not alone, because you were there. But do you know what I mean? Anyway, I'm rambling away. I shall send this off to you. But what please don't think I'm criticising the podcast, because it's brilliant. I'm just criticising myself, which was inevitable. That sound wasn't a fart, by the way. It was just kicking some trainers around on the floor. Okay. That's my morning exercise. I don't go for a run. I just kick the trainers around. That's the kind of joke that could have been on the show. Okay. Bye-bye.